purge of 1936 to 38. Rosa Luxemburg, 1870 to 1919. Great revolutionary theoretician and leader. Originally active in socialist movement of her native Poland, she later became a leader of the left wing of the German Social Democratic Party. She and Karl Liebknecht were imprisoned for opposing World War I. After their release, they led the Spartaksbund. Both were arrested and assassinated during the unsuccessful revolution of 1919. At the session of the Polish Commission of the Executive Committee of the Communist International on July 2, 1926, the author of these lines said on the subject of the events in Poland, "Taken as a whole, the Pilsudski overthrow is the petty bourgeoisie, plebeian manner of solving the burning problems of bourgeois society in its state of decomposition and decline. We have here already a direct resemblance to Italian fascism." These two currents indubitably possess common features. They recruit their shock troops, first of all, from the petty bourgeoisie. Pilsudski, as well as Mussolini, worked with extra-parliamentary means, with open violence, with the methods of civil war. Both were concerned not with the destruction, but with the preservation of bourgeois society. While they raised the petty bourgeoisie on its feet, they openly aligned themselves, after the seizure of power, with the big bourgeoisie. Involuntarily, a historical generalization comes up here, recalling the evaluation given by Marx of Jacobinism as the plebeian method of settling accounts with the feudal enemies of the bourgeoisie. That was in the period of the rise of the bourgeoisie. Now we must say, in the period of the decline of bourgeois society, the bourgeoisie again needs the plebeian method of resolving its no longer progressive but entirely reactionary tasks. In this sense, fascism is a caricature of Jacobinism. The bourgeoisie is incapable of maintaining itself in power by the means and methods of the parliamentary state created by itself. It needs fascism as a weapon of self-defense, at least in critical instances. Nevertheless, the bourgeoisie does not like the plebeian method of resolving its tasks. It was always hostile of Jacobinism, which cleared the road for the development of bourgeois society with its blood. The fascists are immeasurably closer to the decadent bourgeoisie than the Jacobins, or to the rising bourgeoisie. Nevertheless, the sober bourgeoisie does not look very favorable even upon the fascist mode of resolving its tasks. For the concussions, although they are brought forth in the interests of bourgeois society, are linked up with dangers to it. Therefore, the opposition between fascism and the bourgeois parties. The big bourgeoisie likes fascism as little as a man with aching molars likes to have his teeth pulled. The sober circles of bourgeois society have followed with misgivings the work of the dentist Pilsudski, but in the last analysis they have become reconciled to the inevitable, though with threats, with horse trades, and all sorts of bargaining. Thus, the petty bourgeoisie's idol of yesterday becomes transformed into the gendarme of capital. To this attempt at marking out the historical place of fascism as the political reliever of the social democracy, there was counterposed the theory of social fascism. At first, it could appear as a pretentious, blustering, but harmless stupidity. Subsequent events have shown what a pernicious influence the Stalinist theory actually exercised on the entire development of the Communist International. Does it follow from the historical role of Jacobinism, of democracy, and of fascism, that the petty bourgeoisie is condemned to remain a tool in the hands of capital to the end of its days? If things were so, then the dictatorship of the proletariat would be impossible in a number of countries in which the petty bourgeoisie constitutes the majority of the nation and, more than that, it would be rendered extremely difficult in other countries in which the petty bourgeoisie represents an important minority. Fortunately, things are not so. The experience of the Paris Commune, first dictatorship of the proletariat, March 18, 1871, first showed, at least within the limits of one city, just as the experience of the October Revolution, Russian Revolution of 1917, has shown after it on a much larger scale and over an incomparably longer period, that the alliance of the petty bourgeoisie and the big bourgeoisie is not indissoluble. Since the petty bourgeoisie is incapable of an independent policy, this is also why the petty bourgeois democratic dictatorship is unrealizable. No other choice is left for it than that between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. In the epoch of the rise, the growth, and the bloom of capitalism, the petty bourgeoisie, despite acute outbreaks of discontent, generally marched obediently in the capitalist harness, nor could it do anything else. But under the conditions of capitalist disintegration and of the impasse in the economic situation, the petty bourgeoisie attempts to tear itself loose from the fetters of the old masters and rulers of society. It is quite capable of linking up its fates with that of the proletariat. For that, only one thing is needed. The petty bourgeoisie must acquire faith in the ability of the proletariat to lead society onto a new road. The proletariat can inspire this faith only by its strength, by the firmness of its actions, by a skillful offensive against the enemy, by the success of its revolutionary policy. But woe if the revolutionary party does not measure up the height of the situation. The daily struggle of the proletariat sharpens the instability of bourgeois society. The strikes and the political disturbances aggravated the economic situation of the country. The petty bourgeoisie could reconcile itself temporarily to the growing privations. If it arrived by experience at the conviction that the proletariat is in a position to lead it onto a new road. But if the revolutionary party, in spite of a class struggle becoming incessantly more accentuated, proves time and again to be incapable of uniting the working class about it, if it vacillates, becomes confused, contradicts itself, then the petty bourgeoisie loses patience and begins to look upon the revolutionary workers as those responsible for its own misery. All the bourgeois parties, including the social democracy, turn its thoughts in this very direction. When the social crisis takes on an intolerable acuteness, a particular party appears on the scene with a direct aim of agitating the petty bourgeoisie to a white heat and of directing its hatred and its despair against the proletariat. In Germany, this historical function is fulfilled by National Socialism, Nazism, a broad current whose ideology is composed of all the putrid vapors of disintegrating bourgeois society. The Collapse of the Bourgeois Democracy, from Wither, France, 1934. After the war, a series of brilliantly victorious revolutions occurred in Russia, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and later in Spain. But it was only in Russia that the proletariat took full power into its hands, expropriated its exploiters, and knew how to create and maintain a worker state. Everywhere else, the proletariat, despite its victory, stopped halfway because of the mistakes of its leadership. As a result, power slipped from its hands, shifted from left to right, and fell prey to fascism. In a series of other countries, power passed into the hands of a military dictatorship. Nowhere were the parliaments capable of reconciling class contradictions and assuring the peaceful development of events. Conflicts were solved, arms in hand. The French people for a long time thought that fascism had nothing whatever to do with them. They had a republic in which all questions were dealt with by the sovereign people through the exercise of universal suffrage. But on February 6, 1934, several thousand fascists and royalists, armed with revolvers, clubs, and razors, imposed upon the country the reactionary government of Dalmurg, under whose protection the fascist bands continue to grow and arm themselves. What does tomorrow hold? Note, Gaston Dalmurg, Bonapartist premier of France, succeeded Edouard Daladier. Daladier government fell the day after the fascist riots of February 6, 1934. Of course, in France, as in certain other European countries, England, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, the Scandinavian countries, there still exist parliaments, elections, democratic liberties, or their remnants. But in all these countries, the same historic laws operate. The laws of capitalist decline. If the means of production remain in the hands of a small number of capitalists, there is no way out of society. It is condemned to go from crisis to crisis, from need to misery, from bad to worse. In the various countries, the decrepitude and disintegration of capitalism are expressed in diverse forms and at unequal rhythms. But the basic features of the process are the same everywhere. The bourgeoisie is leading its society to complete bankruptcy. It is capable of assuring the people neither bread nor peace. This is precisely why it cannot any longer tolerate the democratic order. It is forced to smash the workers and peasants by the use of physical violence. The discontent of the workers and peasants, however, cannot be brought to an end by the police alone. Moreover, if it is often impossible to make the army march against the people, it begins by disintegrating and ends with the passage of a large section of the soldiers over to the people's side. This is why finance capital is obliged to create special armed bands, trained to fight the workers just as certain breeds of dog are trained to hunt game. The historic function of fascism is to smash the working class, destroy its organizations, and stifle political liberties when the capitalists find themselves unable to govern and dominate with the help of democratic machinery. The fascists find their human material mainly in the petty bourgeoisie. The latter has been entirely ruined by big capital. There is no way out for it in the present social order, but it knows of no other. Its dissatisfaction, indignation, and despair are diverted by the fascists away from big capital and against the workers. It may be said that fascism is the act of placing the petty bourgeoisie at the disposal of its most bitter enemies. In this way, big capital ruins the middle classes and then, with the help of hired fascist demagogues, incites the despairing petty bourgeoisie against the worker. The bourgeois regime can be preserved only by such murderous means as these. For how long? Until it is overthrown by proletarian revolution. Does the petty bourgeoisie fear revolution? From Wither, France, 1934. Parliamentary cretins, who consider themselves connoisseurs of the people, like to repeat, one must not frighten the middle classes with revolution. They do not like extremes. In this general form, this affirmation is absolutely false. Naturally, the petty proprietor prefers order so long as business is going well and so long as he hopes that tomorrow it will go better. But when this hope is lost, he is easily enraged and is ready to give himself over to the most extreme measures. Otherwise, how could he have overthrown the democratic state and brought fascism to power in Italy and Germany? The despairing petty bourgeois sees in fascism, above all, a fighting force against big capital and believes that, unlike the working class parties which deal only in words, fascism will use force to establish more justice. The peasant and the artisan are in their manner realists. They understand that one cannot forego the use of force. It is false, thrice false, to affirm that the present petty bourgeoisie is not going to the working class parties because it fears extreme measures. Quite the contrary. The lower petty bourgeoisie, its great masses, only see in the working class parties parliamentary machines. They do not believe in their strength, nor in their capacity to struggle, nor in their readiness this time to conduct the struggle to the end. And if this is so, is it worth the trouble to replace the democratic capitalist representatives by their parliamentary confreres on the left? This is how the semi-exploited, ruined, and discontented proprietor reasons of feels. Without an understanding of the psychology of the peasants, the artisans, the employees, the petty functionaries, etc., a psychology which flows from the social crisis, it is impossible to elaborate a correct policy. The petty bourgeoisie is economically dependent and politically atomized. That is why it cannot conduct an independent policy. It needs a leader who inspires it with confidence. This individual or collective leadership, i.e. a personage or party, can be given to it by one or the other of the fundamental classes, either the big bourgeoisie or the proletariat. Fascism unites and arms the scattered masses. Out of human dust, it organizes combat detachments. It thus gives the petty bourgeoisie the illusion of being an independent force. It begins to imagine that it will really command the state. It is not surprising that these illusions and hopes turn the head of the petty bourgeoisie. But the petty bourgeoisie can also find a leader in the proletariat. This was demonstrated in Russia and partially in Spain. In Italy, in Germany, and in Austria, the petty bourgeoisie gravitated in this direction. But the parties of the proletariat did not rise to their historic task. To bring the petty bourgeoisie to its side, the proletariat must win its confidence. And for that, it must have confidence in its own strength. It must have a clear program of action and must be ready to struggle for power by all possible means. Tempered by its revolutionary party for a decisive and pitiless struggle, proletariat says to the peasants and petty bourgeoisie of the cities, we are struggling for power. Here is our program. We already discussed with you changes in this program. We will employ violence only against big capital and its lackeys. But with you toilers, we desire to conclude an alliance on the basis of a given program. The peasants will understand such language. Only they must have faith in the capacity of the proletariat to seize power. But for that, it is necessary to purge the united front of all equivocation, of all indecision, of all hollow phrases. It is necessary to understand the situation and to place oneself seriously on the revolutionary road. The workers' militia and its opponents. From Wither, France, 1934. To struggle, it is necessary to conserve and strengthen the instrument and the means of struggle. Organizations, the press, meetings, etc. Fascism, in France, threatens all of that directly and immediately. It is still too weak for the direct struggle for power, but it is strong enough to attempt to beat down the working class organizations bit by bit, to temper its bands in its attacks, and to spread dismay and lack of confidence in their forces in the ranks of the workers. Fascism finds unconscious helpers in all those who say that the physical struggle is impermissible or hopeless, and demand of Dalmerg the disarmament of his fascist guard. Nothing is so dangerous for the proletariat, especially in the present situation, as the sugared poison of false hopes. Nothing increases the insolence of the fascists so much as flabby pacifism on the part of the workers' organizations. Nothing so destroys the confidence of the middle classes and the working class as temporizing, passivity, and the absence of the will to struggle. Le Populaire, the Socialist Party paper, and especially Le Humanite, the Communist Party newspaper, write every day, "The United Front is a barrier against fascism. The United Front will not permit. The fascists will not dare," etc. These are the phrases. It is necessary to say squarely to the workers, socialists and communists, do not allow yourselves to be lulled by the phrases of superficial and irresponsible journalists and orators. It is a question of our heads and the future of socialism. It is not that we deny the importance of the United Front. We demanded it when the leaders of both parties were against it. The United Front opens up numerous possibilities, but nothing more. In itself, the United Front decides nothing. Only the struggle of the masses decides. The United Front will reveal its value when communist detachments will come to the help of socialist detachments and vice versa in the case of an attack by the fascist bands against Le Populaire or Le Humanite. But for that, proletarian combat detachments must exist and be educated, trained, and armed. And if there is not an organization of defense, i.e. a workers' militia, Le Populaire or Le Humanite will be able to write as many articles as they like on the omnipotence of the United Front. But the two papers will find themselves defenseless before the first well-prepared attack of the fascists. We propose to make a critical study of the arguments and the theories of the opponents of the workers' militia, who are very numerous and influential in the two working-class parties. We need mass self-defense and not the militia, we are often told. But what is this mass self-defense without combat organizations, without specialized cadres, without arms? To give over the defense against fascism to unorganized and unprepared masses left to themselves would be to play a role incomparably lower than the role of Pontius Pilate. To deny the role of the militia is to deny the role of the vanguard. Then why a party? Without the support of the masses, the militia is nothing. But without organized combat detachments, the most heroic masses will be smashed bit by bit by the fascist gangs. It is nonsense to counterpose the militia to self-defense. The militia is an organ of self-defense. To call for the organization of a militia, say some opponents who, to be sure, are the least serious and honest, is to engage in provocation. This is not an argument but an insult. If the necessity for the defense of the workers' organizations flows from the whole situation, how then can one not call for the creation of the militia? Perhaps they mean to say that the creation of a militia provokes fascist attacks and government repression. In that case, this is an absolutely reactionary argument. Liberalism has always said to the workers that by their class struggle, they provoke the reaction. The reformists repeated this accusation against the Marxists, the Mensheviks, against the Bolsheviks. These accusations reduce themselves, in the final analysis, to the profound thought that if the oppressed do not balk, the oppressors will not be obliged to beat them. This is the philosophy of Tolstoy and Gandhi, but never that of Marx and Lenin. If Le Humanite wants hereafter to develop the doctrine of non-resistance to evil by violence, it should take for its symbol not the hammer and sickle, emblem of the October Revolution, but the pious goat which provides Gandhi with his milk. But the arming of the workers is only opportune in a revolutionary situation, which does not yet exist. This profound argument means that the workers must permit themselves to be slaughtered until the situation becomes revolutionary. Those who yesterday preached the third person do not want to see what is going on before their eyes. The question of arms itself has come forward only because the peaceful, normal, democratic situation has given way to a stormy, critical, and unstable situation, which can transform itself into a revolutionary as well as a counter-revolutionary situation. Note, the third period, according to the Stalinist schema, this was the final period of capitalism, the period of it immediately impending demise and replacement by Soviets. The period is notable for the communists' ultra-left and adventuristic tactics, notably the concept of social fascism. This alternative depends above all on whether the advanced workers will allow themselves to be attacked with impunity and defeated bit by bit, or will reply to every blow by two of their own, arousing the courage of the oppressed and uniting them around their banner. A revolutionary situation does not fall from the skies. It takes form with the active participation of the revolutionary class and its party. The French Stalinists now argue that the militia did not safeguard the German proletariat from defeat. Only yesterday, they completely denied any defeat in Germany and asserted that the policy of the German Stalinists was correct from beginning to end. Today, they see the entire evil in the German workers' militia, Rote Front, i.e. Red Front Fighters, communist-dominated militia banned by the Social Democratic government after the Berlin May Day riots of 1929. Thus, from one error, they fall into a diametrically opposite one, no less monstrous. The militia in itself does not settle the question. A correct policy is necessary. Meanwhile, the policy of Stalinism in Germany, social fascism is the chief enemy, the split in the trade unions, the flirtation with nationalism, Putschism, fatally led to the isolation of the proletarian vanguard and to its shipwreck. With an utterly worthless strategy, no militia could have saved the situation. It is nonsense to say that, in itself, the organization of the militia leads to adventures, provokes the enemy, replaces the political struggle by physical struggle, etc. In all these phrases, there is nothing but political cowardice. The militia, as the strong organization of the vanguard, is in fact the surest defense against adventures, against individual terrorism, against bloody spontaneous explosions. The militia is at the same time the only serious way of reducing to a minimum the civil war that fascism imposes upon the proletariat. Let the workers, despite the absence of a revolutionary situation, occasionally correct the Papa's son patriots in their own way, and the recruitment of new fascist bands will become incomparably more difficult. But here, the strategists tangled in their own reasoning bring forward against us still more stupefying arguments. We quote textually, "If we reply to the revolver shots of the fascists with other revolver shots," writes Le Humanite of October 23, 1934, "we lose sight of the fact that fascism is the product of the capitalist regime and that in fighting against fascism, it is the entire system which we face. It is difficult to accumulate in a few lines greater confusion or more errors. It is impossible to defend oneself against the fascists because they are a product of the capitalist regime. That means we have to renounce the whole struggle, for all contemporary social evils are products of the capitalist system. When the fascists kill a revolutionist or burn down the building of a proletarian newspaper, the workers are to sigh philosophically, alas, murders and arson are products of the capitalist system, and go home with easy consciences. Fatalist prostration is substituted for the military theory of Marx to the sole advantage of the class enemy. The ruin of the petty bourgeoisie is, of course, the product of capitalism. The growth of the fascist bands is, in turn, a product of the ruin of the petty bourgeoisie. But on the other hand, the increase in the misery and the revolt of the proletariat are also products of capitalism and the militia. In its turn, is the product of the sharpening of the class struggle. Why, then, for the Marxists of Le Humanite, are the fascist bands the legitimate product of capitalism and the workers' militia the illegitimate product of the Trotskyists? Is it impossible to make head or tail of this? We have to deal with the whole system, we are told. How? Over the heads of human beings? The fascists in the different countries began with their revolvers and ended by destroying the whole system of workers' organizations. How else to check the armed offensive of the enemy, if not by an armed defense in order, in our turn, to go over to the offensive? La Humanite now admits defense in words, but only in the form of mass self-defense. The militia is harmful because, you see, it divides the combat detachments from the masses. But why then are there independent armed detachments among the fascists who are not cut off from the reactionary masses, but who, on the contrary, arouse the courage and embolden those masses by their well-organized attacks? Or perhaps the proletarian mass is inferior in combative quality to the declassed petty bourgeoisie. Hopelessly tangled, Le Humanite finally begins to hesitate. It appears that mass self-defense requires the creation of special self-defense groups in place of the rejected militia. Special groups or detachments are proposed. It would seem at first sight that there is a difference only in the name. Certainly, the name proposed by Le Humanite means nothing. One can speak of mass self-defense, but it is impossible to speak of self-defense groups, since the purpose of the groups is not to defend themselves, but the workers' organizations. However, it is not, of course, a question of the name. The self-defense groups, according to La Humanite, must renounce the use of arms in order not to fall into Putschism. These sages treat the working class like an infant who must not be allowed to hold a razor in his hands. Razors, moreover, are the monopoly, as we know, of the Camelots de Roe, French monarchists grouped around Charles Maurras' newspaper, Action Francois, which was violently anti-democratic, who are a legitimate product of capitalism and who, with the aid of razors, have overthrown the system of democracy. In any case, how are the self-defense groups going to defend themselves against the fascist revolvers? Ideologically, of course. In those words, they can hide themselves. Not having what they require in their hands, they will have to seek self-defense in their feet. And the fascists will, in the meanwhile, sack the workers' organizations with impunity. But if the proletariat suffers a terrible defeat, it will at any rate not have been guilty of putschism. This fraudulent chatter, parading under the banner of Bolshevism, arouses only disgust and loathing. During the third period of happy memory, when the strategists of Le Humanite were afflicted with barricade delirium, conquered the streets every day, and stamped as social fascist everyone who did not share their extravagances, we predicted, the moment these gentlemen burn the tips of their fingers, they will become the worst opportunists. That prediction has now been completely confirmed. At a time when, within the Socialist Party, the movement in favor of the militia is growing and strengthening, the leaders of the so-called Communist Party run for the hose to cool down the desire of the advanced workers to organize themselves in fighting columns. Could one imagine a more demoralizing or more damning work than this? In the ranks of the Socialist Party, sometimes this objection is heard. A militia must be formed, but there is no need of shouting about it. One can only congratulate comrades who wish to protect the practical side of the business from inquisitive eyes and ears. But it would be much too naive to think that a militia could be created unseen and secretly within four walls. We need tens and later hundreds of thousands of fighters. They will come only if millions of men and women workers, and behind them the peasants, understand the necessity for the militia and create around the volunteers an atmosphere of ardent sympathy and active support. Conspiratorial care can and must envelop only the technical aspect of the matter. The political campaign must be openly developed in meetings, factories, in the streets, and on the public squares. The fundamental cadres of the militia must be the factory workers grouped according to their place of work, known to each other, and able to protect their combat detachments against the provocations of enemy agents far more easily and more surely than the most elevated bureaucrats. Conspirative general staffs without an open mobilization of the masses will, at the moment of danger, remain impotently suspended in midair. Every working-class organization has to plunge into the job. In this question, there can be no line of demarcation between the working-class parties and the trade unions. Hand in hand, they must mobilize the masses. The success of the people militia will then be fully assured. But where are the workers going to get arms? Object the sober. Realists, that is to say, frightened Philistines. The enemy has rifles, cannon, tanks, gas, and airplanes. The workers have a few hundred revolvers and pocket knives. In this objection, everything is piled up to frighten the workers. On the one hand, our sages identify the arms of the fascists with the armament of the state. On the other hand, they turn towards the state and demand that it disarm the fascists. Remarkable logic. In fact, their position is false in both cases. In France, the fascists are still far from controlling the state. On February 6, they entered in armed conflict with the state police. That is why it is false to speak of cannon and tanks when it is a matter of the immediate armed struggle against the fascists. The fascists, of course, are richer than we. It is easier for them to buy arms. But the workers are more numerous, more determined, more devoted when they are conscious of a firm revolutionary leadership. In addition to other sources, the workers can arm themselves at the expense of the fascists by systematically disarming them. This is now one of the most serious forms of the struggle against fascism. When workers' arsenals will begin to stock up at the expense of the fascist arms depots, the banks and trusts will be more prudent in financing the armament of their murderous guards. It would even be possible in this case, but in this case only, that the alarmed authorities would really begin to prevent the arming of the fascists in order not to provide an additional sources of arms for the workers. We have known for a long time that only a revolutionary tactic engenders, as a byproduct, reforms or concessions from the government. But how to disarm the fascists? Naturally, it is impossible to do so with newspaper articles alone. Fighting squads must be created. An intelligence service must be established. Thousands of informers and friendly helpers will volunteer from all sides when they realize that the business has been seriously undertaken by us. It requires a will to proletarian action. But the arms of the fascists are, of course, not the only source. In France, there are more than 1 million organized workers. Generally speaking, this number is small, but it is entirely sufficient to make a beginning in the organization of a workers' militia. If the parties and unions armed only a tenth of their members, that would already be a force of 100,000 men. There is no doubt whatever that the number of volunteers who would come forward on the morrow of a united front appeal for a workers' militia would far exceed that number. The contributions of the parties and unions, collections and voluntary subscriptions would within a month or two make it possible to assure the arming of 100,000 to 200,000 working class fighters. The fascist rabble would immediately sink its tail between its legs. The whole perspective of development would become incomparably more favorable. To invoke the absence of arms or other objective reasons to explain why no attempt has been made up to now to create a militia is to fool oneself and others. The principal obstacle, one can say the only obstacle, has its roots in the conservative and passive character of the leaders of the workers' organizations. The skeptics who are the leaders do not believe in the strength of the proletariat. They put their hope in all sorts of miracles from above instead of giving a revolutionary outlet to the energies pulsing below. The socialist workers must compel their leaders to pass over immediately to the creation of the workers' militia or else give way to younger, fresher voices. A strike is inconceivable without propaganda and without agitation. It is also inconceivable without pickets who, when they can, use persuasion, but when obliged, use force. The strike is the most elementary form of the class struggle, which always combines in varying proportions ideological methods with physical methods. The struggle against fascism is basically a political struggle which needs a militia, just as the strike needs pickets. Basically, the picket is the embryo of the workers' militia. He who thinks of renouncing physical struggle must renounce all struggle, for the spirit does not live without flesh. Following the splendid phrase of the great military theoretician Clausewitz, war is the continuation of politics by other means. This definition also fully applies to civil war. It is impermissible to oppose one to the other since it's impossible to check at the will the political struggle when it transforms itself by force of inner necessity into a political struggle. The duty of revolutionary party is to foresee in time the inescapability of the transformation of politics into open armed conflict, and with all its forces to prepare for that moment, just as the ruling classes are preparing. The militia detachment for defense against fascism are the first step on the road to the arming of the proletariat, not the last. Our slogan is, arm the proletariat and the revolutionary peasants. The workers' militia must, in the final analysis, embrace all the toilers. To fulfill this program completely would be possible only in a worker state into whose hands would pass all the means of production and, consequently, also all the means of destruction, i.e., all the arms and the factories which produce them. However, it is impossible to arrive at a worker state with empty hands. Only political invalids like Rinaldo can speak of a peaceful constitutional road to socialism. The constitutional road is cut by trenches held by the fascist bands. There are not a few trenches before us. The bourgeoisie will not hesitate to resort to a dozen coups d'etat, aided by the police and the army, to prevent proletariat from coming to power. Note, Pierre Renaudel, 1871 to 1935. Prior to World War I, socialist leader Jean Jaurès, right-handed man and editor of La Humanite, during the war, a right-wing social patriot. In the 1930s, he and Marcel Dietz led revisionist neo-socialist tendency, voted down at the July 1933 convention. This tendency split from the Socialist Party. After the fascist riots of February 6, 1934, most of the neos joined the Radical Party, the main party of French capitalism. A workers' socialist state can be created only by a victorious revolution. Every revolution is prepared by the march of economic and political development, but it is always decided by open armed conflicts between hostile classes. A revolutionary victory can become possible only as a result of long political agitation, a lengthy period of education and organization of the masses. But the armed conflict itself must likewise be prepared long in advance. The advanced workers must know that they will have to fight and win a struggle to the death. They must reach out for arms as a guarantee of their emancipation. The perspective in the United States. From Some Questions on American Problems, 4th International, October 1940. The backwardness of the United States working class is only a relative term. In very many important respects, it is the most progressive working class of the world, technically and in its standard of living. The American workers are very combative, as we have seen during the strikes. They have had the most rebellious strikes in the world. What the American worker misses is a spirit of generalization or analysis of his class position in a society as a whole. This lack of social thinking has its origin in the country's whole history about fascism. In all the countries where fascism became victorious, we had, before the growth of fascism and its victory, a wave of radicalism of the masses, of the workers and the poor peasants and farmers, and of the petty bourgeois class. In Italy, after the war and before 1922, we had a revolutionary wave of tremendous dimensions. The state was paralyzed. The police did not exist. The trade unions could do anything they wanted, but there was not party capable of taking the power. As a reaction came fascism. In Germany, the same. We had a revolutionary situation in 1918. The bourgeois class did not even ask to participate in the power. The Social Democrats paralyzed the revolution. Then the workers tried again in 1922, 23, 24. This was the time of the bankruptcy of the Communist Party, all of which we have gone into before. Then in 1929, 30, 31, the German workers began again a new revolutionary wave. There was a tremendous power in the communists and in the trade unions. But then came the famous policy on the part of the Stalinist movement of social fascism, a policy invented to paralyze the working class. Only after these three tremendous waves did fascism become a big movement. There was no exceptions to this rule. Fascism comes only when the working class shows complete incapacity to take into its own hands the fate of society. In the United States, you will have the same thing. Already there are fascist elements, and they have, of course, the examples of Italy and Germany. They will therefore work in a more rapid tempo. But you also have the examples of other countries. The next historic wave in the United States will be the wave of radicalism of the masses, not fascism. Of course, the war can hinder the radicalization for some time, but then it will give to the radicalization a more tremendous tempo and swing. We must not identify war dictatorship, the dictatorship of the military machine, of the staff, of finance, capital, with a fascist dictatorship. For the latter, there is first necessary a feeling of desperation of large masses of the people, when the revolutionary parties betray them, when the vanguard of workers show it incapacity to lead the people to victory. Then the farmers, the small businessmen, the unemployed, the soldiers, etc., become capable of supporting a fascist movement, but only then. A military dictatorship is purely a bureaucratic institution, reinforced by the military machine and based upon the disorientation of the people and their submission to it. After some time, their feelings can change and they can become rebellious against the dictatorship. Build the Revolutionary Party. In every discussion of political topics, the question arises, shall we succeed in creating a strong party for the moment when the crisis comes? Might not fascism anticipate us? Isn't a fascist stage of development inevitable? The successes of fascism easily make people lose all perspective, lead them to forget the actual conditions which made the strengthening and the victory of fascism possible. Yet a clear understanding of these conditions is of a special importance to the workers of the United States. We may set it down as a historical law. Fascism was able to conquer only in those countries where the conservative labor parties prevented the proletariat from utilizing the revolutionary situation and seizing power. In Germany, two revolutionary situations were involved, 1918 through 1919 and 1923 through 1924. Even in 1929, a direct struggle for power on the part of the proletariat was still possible. In all these three cases, the social democracy and the Comintern, the Stalinists, criminally and viciously disrupted the conquest of power and thereby placed society in an impasse. Only under these conditions and in this situation did the stormy rise of fascism and its gaining of power prove possible. Insofar as the proletariat proves incapable at a given stage of conquering power, imperialism begins regulating economic life with its own methods. The fascist party, which becomes the state power, is the political mechanism. The productive forces are in irreconcilable contradiction, not only with the private property, but also with national state boundaries. Imperialism is the very expression of this contradiction. Imperialist capitalism seeks to solve this contradiction through an extension of boundaries, seizure of new territories, and so on. The totalitarian state, subjecting all aspects of economic, political, and culture life to finance capital, is the instrument for creating a supranationalist state or imperialist empire, the rule over continents, the rule over the whole world. All these traits of freedom we have analyzed, each one by itself, and all of them in their totality to the extent that they became manifest or came to the forefront. Both theoretical analysis as well as the rich historical experience of the last quarter of a century have demonstrated with equal force that fascism is each time the final link of a specific political cycle composed of the following. The gravest crisis of capitalist society, the growth of the radicalization of the working class, the growth of sympathy toward the working class, and a yearning for change on the part of the rural and urban petty bourgeoisie, the extreme confusion of the big bourgeoisie, its cowardly and treacherous maneuvers aimed at avoiding the revolutionary climax, the exhaustion of the proletariat, growing confusion and indifference, the aggravation of the social crisis, the despair of the petty bourgeoisie, its yearning for change, the collective neurosis of the petty bourgeoisie, its readiness to believe in miracles, its readiness for violent measures, the growth of hostility towards the proletariat, which has deceived its expectations. These are the premises for a swift formation of a fascist party and its victory. It is quite self-evident that the radicalization of the working class in the United States has passed through only its initial phases, almost exclusively in the sphere of the trade union movement, the CIO. The pre-war period and then the war itself may temporarily interrupt this process of radicalization, especially if a considerable number of workers are absorbed into war industry. But this interpretation of the process of radicalization cannot be of a long duration. The second stage of radicalization will assume a more sharply expressive character. The problem of forming an independent labor party will be put on the order of the day. Our transitional demands will gain great popularity. On the other hand, the fascist, reactionary tendencies will withdraw to the background, assuming a defensive position, awaiting a more favorable moment. This is the nearest perspective. No occupation is more completely unworthy than that of speculating whether or not we shall succeed in creating a powerful revolutionary leader party. Ahead lies a favorable perspective, providing all the justification for revolutionary activism. It is necessary to utilize the opportunities which are opening up and to build the revolutionary party. This has been Fascism, What It Is and How to Fight It by Leon Trotsky.